I'm Kevin DeCristofano.
I'm Sean Flanagan. We are the Ninja Turtle Nerds, your weekly podcast where we discuss the Ninja Turtle comics one epic storyline at a time. How you been?
Been reading comics, you know? It's a comic podcast, go figure. Well, I started Immortal Hulk, which has been sitting in my Marvel Unlimited library forever.
What you think?
You know what's funny about it? I read comic books at night to go to bed. Like, it, you know, puts me to sleep. And I usually read, like, three or four comics in bed on my tablet. And it's funny, because lately I've been reading 60s Daredevil. I'm trying to read the full Daredevil run, and I'm starting at the beginning. And I've read 60s Spider-Man 2 and Fantastic Four. And the jump to modern-day comics on a tablet, it's so funny, because at one point, I was like, in the first issue of Immortal Hulk, I was like, how far into this book am I? Because on a 60s comic, I'd be on page 2. And I tapped the screen and I saw I was on page 15.
Yep.
And I'm like, because in modern comics, you get like one panel of dialogue for like every four panels. And in the 60s, you get like four things of dialogue for every single panel. It's so much more reading. It's always internal dialogue too. It's always like, oh no, they have discovered my secret, that Matt Murdock, attorney at law, is actually doubling his identity and secret as Daredevil. And it's like always this big internal monologue, and I'm like, we can infer from and this is what modern comics do, is just draw the face. We know what he's thinking. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, you never
just
do that
draw
when
that
you're...
he's worried. We know why he's worried.
You never do that when you're worried, like, oh no, Sean Flanagan, who's been waiting a month to start this job he has.
Yeah. It's also always exposition for, like, I mean, I get that back then, you know, people weren't picking up every issue. They were just grabbing what they could from a newsstand, so you had to fill the reader in. But it feels like every panel has that.
But so you like Immortal Hulk?
I love Silver Age stuff. I can't do Golden Age. Like, I've read, like, the oldest thing I read was, I've read, like, those first few issues of Action Comics, and it's good to do once or twice to know what comics were like in the 30s, but never again.
You liking Hulk?
Yeah, I liked it. I read the first three issues.
Oh, nice.
So I'll definitely read the full series.
I think there's two left. I don't know. I know 50s when it's over. I finally crossed something off my gaming bucket list. I beat Super Metroid.
Woo! I haven't even started it yet. I mean, I played it like, I think I rented that back when it was, you know, back when you would rent Super Nintendo games. But other than that, yeah, it's on my to-do list. So how was the full experience?
I enjoyed it. It was good.
Take me through the game, start to finish. What'd you love?
I mean, it's a really good game. I don't think I'd put it in my top 10 Super Nintendo games, but it's in the top 20. But
that's controversial, because I'm pretty sure it's in every top 10 Super Nintendo game list. Well,
here's why.
I mean, it's not on mine because I haven't played it yet, but you know what I'm saying.
No, even having played it, I mean, it was like 6.5 hours over 2 days, so I figured before Dread, I should at least play one of the other ones, and I enjoyed it, but...
I've played the original start to finish, but I haven't gotten to that one.
I've tried, like, give me three times. I can't get into that original game. So, there was a point in the game, because I probably played about 80% of it without looking stuff up, and I got stuck, and I was like, oh, you get a wall jump. Thank God for save states. If anyone listening beat this actual cartridge, kudos. Because you would think a wall jump would be a simple thing. It took me 45 minutes with save states every time I reached the other side of the gap to get to the top of the level. And it's like, it's the only part of the game that, like, dead stopped for me, but because it's
like in Mega Man 2 when you're in Dr. Wily's castle and you know the dragon is going across and you gotta hop the things, and if you miss one you die.
Oh, that's so much easier. This
Oh, okay.
This is easily one of the most difficult things I've ever done in a game. And all it was jumping. But because it's, you have to jump, hit the opposite direction on the D-pad, and then hit jump again, the timing is so precise. I can't for the life of me believe that they didn't just make it a button on the SNES controller. Instead of having the bumpers be point the gun up or down diagonal, they should have just had that be the wall jump. But yes, other than that 45 minutes, which was hell.
Wow.
I enjoyed it. It's a good game. I can see why it's got a fan base, and I'm probably more excited for Dread, because I'm going to guess a modern Metroid game doesn't have an issue with the wall jump. So. Yeah.
Before we get into things, I wanted to ask you, because you're a little more into movies than I am. Have you seen the new Nicolas Cage film, Pig?
No.
Because I keep seeing posts about it.
And I want to. It is not playing anywhere near here.
So I'm going to say this having not seen it, but everything I keep seeing is like people saying, like, Nicolas Cage is a brilliant actor for this performance. This performance is brilliant. He's so incredibly, like, talented for coming up with this performance. And I just got to get this off my chest as someone who's seen a lot of Nicolas Cage movies. And this might be controversial. He's a good actor. I'll start with that. He is a good actor. But brilliant, I think, is a little... And again, I haven't seen Pig yet. It's handing that out a little too easily because, here's an analogy, he swings big at every pitch sent to him. So, of course, he's going to hit home runs a few times.
Yeah.
And I think that's really like every now and then the performance just matches what the project was supposed to be. But like for every brilliant Nicolas Cage performance, you get 10 that are like, what? What is he doing? You know, so I mean, he was great into Spider-Verse. That's a brilliant Nicolas Cage performance, but I think that's just the people making Into the Spider-Verse knew how to use him, you know?
I mean, the last movie I saw him in was Willy's Wonderland, where he fights animatronics that are possessed by cultist killers or something. I don't know. It was a horror movie, but it was entertaining, and he didn't speak the whole movie, which was an interesting choice. But everything I've seen on Pig, it's not as outlandish and wacky as a lot of what he's been doing. And I
love Adaptation. That's another great
movie. Oh, that was a great movie.
Film of his. Like, he's got great movies and he's got great performances, but again, I think it's just a broken clock is right twice a day situation.
No, I can see that. I mean, he's very far from, like, I laugh if the occasional time they put Oscar winner Nicolas Cage in the trailer, because that was so long ago. And
well, I've seen people say that was when he started taking those big swings. Like, after he got that Oscar, he's like, okay, I'm going to do whatever I want as far as performance goes.
That probably makes sense. I mean, probably the best thing I've seen him in recently was Mandy, which he kind of, he goes big on, but it works for what the movie is. Because there's like a dynamic biker gang that kidnaps his girlfriend, and it's a little wacky.
He's done like 7 They Kidnapped His Girlfriend movies.
Well, that's probably the best of those.
Trespass is his worst. I'm going to throw that out there. Or at least the worst.
I still haven't seen that.
Oh,
I don't know
no
what
good.
The worst Nicolas Cage I've... Probably the gun in Betty Lou's handbag. It's like a early 90s comedy. It was just bad. Like, it wasn't entertaining bad. It was just bad. But I would love to see him team up with the Coen brothers again. I'm shocked it's only happened once.
Yeah, there's so many of those relationships where I start to wonder, like, was there... Because, you know, directors, I mean, look at Christopher Nolan. He puts the same people in every single movie. And that's, I mean, common for a lot of directors. Martin Scorsese, lots of them. And, like, so, like, whenever you see someone work with a specific director a few times and then stop. I always wonder if something happened behind the scenes.
No, he's only done the one movie with the Coens, but just, I don't know. I feel like
that's a perfect... But they repeat actors a lot, so...
That's a perfect match to bring him back, because, I mean, I think the Coens get the best performances out of Clooney.
Yeah.
Frances McDormand, you know, is married to one of them, but they always get great stuff out of her. And then there's just other actors, you know, John Goodman, you really don't realize how great an actor he is until you really kind of see him through the Coen movies. But even
you know, everyone jumps to Big Lebowski for that, but I would say a great John Goodman Coen brother performance is Barton Fink.
Yeah, he's amazing in that movie. And I mean, one of my favorite Coen brothers movies that kind of gets forgotten about is Inside Llewyn Davis, which is just about a folk singer, and it's their usual thing. But John Goodman's in that, and he's fantastic. I can't think of the kid's name. Garrett Hedlund, maybe. He's one of those just like pretty boy actors that's in like, you know, that type of movie, but they have him in it. He's really good. I think that's one of the first times I saw Adam Driver was in that movie. And he was really good in that. And then Oscar Isaac's one of my favorite actors. They've only worked with him once, but yeah, I'd like to see Nicolas Cage team back up with the Coens on something.
But I'll tell you something, Nicolas Cage is not in, and that's City at War Part 4, which is the comic we're talking about today. It's got a story by Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird, a script by Peter Laird and Jim Lawson, pencils by Jim Lawson. Here's pretty much the only credit that's different. Inks by Matt Banning this time, and lettering still by Mary Kelleher. So everything's the same except Matt Banning on inks is different.
And we got
cover date
got AC Farley back on the cover. I don't know how many City at War covers he did, but we'll get into this one.
There's a cover date on here of November of 92, so let's go take a look at November of 1992. This month in entertainment. Some of the movies I wrote down that came out. This isn't like a complete list, it's just what jumped out to me. So movies released November 92, we've got The Bodyguard.
You know, I've never seen that movie.
Really? I think I saw it in 93, like I think my mom rented it. And
you just happened to get
and, like,
trapped.
I was just like, yeah, in the room while it played, yeah. Home Alone 2 also came out in November of 92. You know, starting to be Christmas movie season here.
With the Sticky Bandits.
Here's something. I don't know if you saw this online. I can't remember where it was, but I saw... And it's not the first time I've seen this. Somebody say that Home Alone 2 was better than the first one. And I just can't wrap my head around that.
I can only give that to you if it's the only Home Alone movie you've seen.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not putting it down. It's a good sequel. In fact, it's probably one of the better sequels. Like one of it goes on the list of sequels that weren't disappointing to like
for a movie
something that should have been a one-hit wonder.
That did the same thing, just changed the location. Yeah it's an alright movie.
Yeah. Wet Bandits better than Sticky Bandits. Defending your home is better than defending just some place that you are hiding out in until you figure things out. Like the pizza scene in the first movie is way better than the you know, the what's his name, the guy who plays the little hotel guy.
Tim Curry
in the pizza. Yeah, Tim Curry. Don't get me wrong, Tim Curry's great, but the pizza delivery driver, keep the change, you filthy animal. Way better than the hotel room shooting. But yeah,
I think that was the first movie as a kid when I saw it. I was like, wait a minute. They've already done a bunch of this stuff.
So moving on from that, if you think Home Alone 2 is better than the first one, you know, explain it to me, because I would match it with every point of the first Home Alone and say better, better, better. The neighbor in the first film, way better than the pigeon lady. Just throwing that out there.
The first movie has John Candy.
Exactly, yes. Polka, polka, polka. Okay.
And it has Elvis.
Oh my God! So you know what? Most listeners aren't going to know what this has Elvis means. So did I tell you this?
I don't think so.
So I don't know if it's still out there, but at one point, there's a conspiracy theory group that believes that Elvis is in Home Alone 2, and he's the guy behind the mom in line at the airport. And to me, the guy looks nothing like Elvis. But they're like, this is proof that he faked his death. He's in Home Alone 2 right there. It's so bizarre. And like, there's a section of the internet that believes it. It's crazy.
Why would you fake your death to be in like a just okay sequel to a successful movie?
To just stand behind someone? So other movies from November 92, we have Malcolm X and Bram Stoker's Dracula were the two I also made notes about.
Malcolm X I haven't seen, oddly. There's a lot of movies I got to get around to that are just like, I think it's because they were those rare 90s movies that are 3 hours plus, and because that's become like a staple now, it's a little harder for me to go back and watch movies that are that long.
Yeah.
But Bram Stoker's Dracula, I've grown to appreciate that as I get older. It is hilarious seeing Keanu Reeves try to have a British accent. I saw an interesting interview where Gary Oldman said that was like one of the only movies I can't remember if he said he doesn't usually go out for movies, or if it's people don't usually bring him movies. It's one of those two things. But it was one of the rare instances where he is who they wanted to play Dracula. But it's an alright movie. It's not great. It's got some good Anthony Hopkins, you know, chewing scenery. And Winona and a few of the others do a little better with the accents. But I wouldn't say it's the definitive Dracula movie.
No, that's Dracula Dead and Loving It.
I'm outside and I'm eating chicken.
Music of 1992. You know what's interesting about the movies? The last thing I'll say about them, it's funny. You get this mix here of like Halloween going out and Christmas coming in. Because it's November, you know? All right, Billboard number one songs. November 7th. End of the Road, Boys to Men, and it's the end of the road for End of the Road, ending its 13 weeks at number one. A new record.
Wow.
November 14th was How Do You Talk to an Angel, or an angle if you can't spell, by the Heights. Everyone knows that song. That was number one for 2 weeks. And then November 28th, do you have a guess?
November 28th?
Here's a clue. Think of the movies I mentioned.
I don't know.
All right, so November 28th, I Will Always Love You by Whitney Houston.
Oh, from the bottom. Okay. I always forget
there. I was singing. What's that?
I always forget that song is from that movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. One of the biggest... That was one of the biggest selling soundtracks of all time because of that one song, because that was back when you had to buy the whole movie soundtrack for one song. So, yeah. I don't know if I should give it away here, but it's going to be number one for a while. Expect another end of the road situation. I'm not going to spoil if it beats the record or not, but it's going to be number one for a while.
I feel like that one's going to be talked about a couple episodes.
Out with the old, in with the new. I mean, I think I can pinpoint around this time in the early 90s. It's like when radio stations stopped playing so much variety. Because look at, since I've brought this up on the show before, since we've been doing this segment, like in the 80s and like 1990 and 91, songs would only be number one for like 3 weeks in a row. Now we're seeing songs at number one for 13 straight weeks. And I'm just going to guess, I'm going to attribute that to radio stations probably playing the hits more often and just recycling the same 40 songs. Right. That I think we just pinpointed where that trend started, and it seems like it's the end of 91. Like, it's like November 91 that kind of starts. That's when you start seeing stuff number one for 5, 6, 7 weeks in a row. All right, video games. Nintendo Power cover. It was Darth Vader, like his face. And it said, Super Star Wars,
woo,
challenge the dark side. And then it also said Super Mario Land 2 preview. Not to be confused with Super Mario World 2, which was the Yoshi game. This was the Game Boy Super Mario Land 2, which I was able to find some scans of this issue. So here's some things that I thought were interesting inside the Nintendo Power issue. This, because I can never, like I said, I want to do a list of like what games came out that month, but I can never find that. So I think I might just do this instead from now on. There were two comics inside. They did a Zelda comic and a Super Mario Adventures comic, which is weird because I only ever remember them doing like one comic per issue. So they needed to fill some pages there. Super Mario Land 2, 6 Golden Coins, I just want to point out as one of my all-time favorite Mario games.
I don't think I ever played that one.
Oh, you got to play it. I'm serious. It might be in my top three. Like, Super Mario World, Super Mario RPG, Super Mario Land 2, 6 Golden Coins. Like,
wow,
all fantastic games. And it might just be nostalgia, because I owned it on my Game Boy. But, anyway.
Who's the bad guy in that game?
Wario. It's the first appearance of Wario.
Okay.
And there's also the first Mega Man game has like a throwback guide in here. Like, they were on like Mega Man 5 at the time, I think, but Nintendo Power decided to do a little throwback Mega Man guide. And they also used to do this thing where readers could vote on their favorite games. They would do a top 20 for each system, and I'm going to do the top three here for each one. So the top three NES games that month were Super Mario Brothers 3, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3, The Manhattan Project, what? And Mega Man 4. The top three Super Nintendo games: Street Fighter, The World Warrior, The Legend of Zelda, A Link to the Past, and Super Mario World. Super Mario World in third place. That's crazy.
I'm surprised the first Street Fighter's that high.
It probably I think it had just come out,
yeah, but maybe.
It was a popular game. And the Game Boy top three were Super Mario Land, or Super Mario Lamp, according to my notes. Metroid 2, Return of Samus, and Yoshi, which was the puzzle Yoshi where the things fall and you have to match the like the Goomba to the Goomba and you make the eggs.
All right. Yeah, there was Yoshi and Yoshi's Cookie.
Yeah. TV events. November 27th, we had the TV movie Saved by the Bell Hawaiian Style is broadcast on NBC. November 6th, Nick Arcade ends after 84 episodes, which I think this is the first show we've seen start and end in the time span we've been doing this segment. It started in January of 92. It ended in November of 92. Obviously they reran it a lot, so it didn't stop airing then, but that was all the new they made 84 episodes and they were done. But I like Nick Arcade. It was a good show. Also probably worth mentioning, I don't know if it counts as TV news as much as American history, but Bill Clinton is elected the 42nd president of the United States. So you would have seen that on TV. or read it in a newspaper because it's 92. Saturday Night Live, November 14th, was hosted by Michael Keaton with musical guest Morrissey. And then November 21st, it was hosted by Sinbad with musical guest Sade.
Sade.
And that is all that was going on in the world when City at War Part 4 was first on the newsstands, according to its cover date. I don't think the cover dates are when they actually came out, because they're usually a little off, but it's the only way I can do this segment.
It works. So, that brings us to Part 4 of City at War, which is issue number 53 of Mirage Volume 1.
Where can
one.
We find this guy?
So, you can find it on Comixology and in Ultimate Classics Volume 4.
I will.
So, that Ace Farley cover, that might be one of the best covers in the whole series.
It's a red cover of the elite foot soldier that we've been calling the trash can head guys. And it's all red and he's in the rain, but it looks like he just took a bath in blood, a literal bloodbath.
Yeah, this is definitely my favorite City at War so far cover.
Dude's got some pythons. Look at those! Look at those arms! Like,
I don't know. That seems to be, you know, I know he's done a lot of covers at this point, but this seems to be his masterpiece.
I don't know a lot about martial arts. I wonder what's going on with this shin guard here that looks like it's got a bunch of popsicle sticks in it.
You know, sometimes you want a popsicle.
And every popsicle he finishes, he puts in the bandages around his shins.
Yeah, that's like his weird quirk. It's what separates him from the other foot elite. It's all popsy.
That and the air filter on his head. Sorry, trash can lid. Looks like both.
So when we open this issue, we're back to Splinter meditating in the woods, and it's a great first page. Like, I love everything going on here with the trees kind of making a monument almost in back of him, and it's like you're there with him on the spiritual plane, basically.
There's no mushrooms around, though, because he's not a fun guy.
No, because after this page, we just get back to Splinter, and he's narrating, trying to find his zen, and he can't. So he just says, damn it. This is seriously. So Splinter is still lost right now. And that brings us to Robin and April, and Robin has just dragged April out and about for a pretty woman makeover. As far as I can tell.
One other thing I want to say about the Splinter thing, though, is, and maybe this is because I've recently watched the Netflix series, but it's very reminiscent of like when Iron Fist can't summon his chi, and he's just like trying. Like there's very, very big similarities there. But yeah, let's move on.
Can you believe they compared Splinter to Danny Rand on the Netflix show?
Well, no, I'm talking about the comics, but it's probably fresh in my mind because I just watched the show. But yeah, we learned the cat's name, Cool Bean.
Remember when we used to say that all the time, Cool Bean?
Yeah, another thing we used to say, which is on the next page, well, I don't think we ever said it, but the note I have is April's sister tells her she looks bitchin', and I was like, man, bitchin' didn't last as a slang, huh? Like, it just... like, it feels very 80s to me. And I know this is early 90s, but I feel like even by 92, it was on its way out.
Yeah, I don't remember us ever throwing that one around, but...
yeah, I feel like just saying something is bitchin' is... yeah, it didn't last.
But Cool Beans, definitely. I think we occasionally still throw that out there. I like that April is so bothered by how filthy her sister's apartment is.
Yeah.
Especially because, you know, like, she doesn't have control over too much right now going on in her life. And her sister's even denying her the ability to do this one thing she could do.
She's definitely living a female version of The Odd Couple, which is not Laverne and Shirley.
Very, very different shows.
Yeah.
So we get back to Casey with Gabrielle, and when we first see Casey, it looks like he's waking up from a dream about April, which I thought was interesting.
Well, he definitely is. He's saying her name. He's like, oh, April? Oh, man. What time is it? Where am I? That's basically what he says.
So he's still at Gabrielle's, the waitress's, and she's in the bathroom sick for some mysterious reason, which turns out to be she's 3 months pregnant. Casey freaks out, but don't worry, it's not his. Some other guy's before him.
Which, I mean, I get that this happens in real life, but, and I don't know if I'm on the wrong end of this and I'm going to get, you know, shut down on Twitter, but I feel like that is a before things get as serious as they are with these two. I feel like that's something that needs to come up, just letting the other person know, hey, before we get too serious into this thing, you should know.
You would think that, but I don't know what them kids were doing in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And
he says he'll stay with her. He does the right thing. Or, I mean, he doesn't come out and say that, but she says, are you going to leave me? And he skirts around it. He says, if I stay, it's because I want to. So he doesn't say he's going to stay, but he says, if he stays, it'll be because he wants to.
And he's drawn and again.
Not because he feels sorry for her, because she says, you know, don't feel sorry for me.
Right. Casey is yet again drawn Wolverine Harry. So that's his new look, I guess.
I like the look when he's on his way to the bathroom and he's just in his underwear. It's like kind of Tarzan looking.
So that this one little moment in this book did something remarkable. It made me care what's going on with Casey. So it's only taken 6 issues of things going on with him for me to finally come around and be like, okay, all right. He's going to do the right thing. He's going to stay with this girl whose kid is not his, but all right then.
And then you get something that we did not get in the 3rd Ninja Turtles movie, which is we can see Splinter's feet. Because they only made the top of that puppet.
Is one of the best panels in this issue, in my opinion. I just really like it. I don't know why. Just
no, it stood out to me too, and I think it's just because like that's what a rat's feet would look like if he was 4 feet tall or however tall he is, and it just kind of it reminds you that he's old and frail, but at the same time he's a ninja master and he can handle business.
Just before we see his feet, there's one pretty unneeded panel of that old man in the hospital. Just so you know, he's on the mend. He's got less bandages on.
We're gonna keep checking in with him. So jury's still out on if it's worth it or not, but we'll get to it by the end of the series.
Splinter is wandering the woods of Northampton and stumbles upon some familiar dilapidated buildings that we last saw in Tales number 4.
Mm-hmm.
That's as far as I'll go with that, because it's going to come into play. But if you've been with us this whole time, you probably know what's coming for Splinter.
Yeah.
And then we go back to New York City to this amazing 2-panel spread of the battle, which is just all-out craziness now. It's turtles, foot, police...
horny robots. This is what you buy the comic for. Like, so many good. It's just another one of those things that we've been saying pretty much since issue 1 is when they get down to it and they want to just draw a big brawl, a crazy melee, They are so good at it. Like, there's a great panel where this Raphael is like choking a foot soldier with his own chain weapon, the thing with the, yep, the chain with the weight at two ends. It's just like, I don't know. It feels like, you know what it kind of feels like? It, in Return of the Jedi, when they cut to like the Endor battle and things are in full swing, like it's like chaos going, yep, on.
So that two-page spread, it took me forever to find Raph. I found Leo and Mikey and Donnie, but it took me a while to find Raph, and I was like, oh, there he is.
Well, I mean, I use this phrase a lot, but it is a Where's Waldo. There's so much going on. There's, like, cars exploding and robots, and there's, you know, ninjas, every type of ninja weapon being used. It's the helicopters. Everything is happening.
So the Foot Elite from the cover finally gets into, you know, the battle, and you get another great two-page spread where we finally get some great sound effects porn. Like, I don't know, I love the setup of these two pages and the way everything's put together. And then we get a full page of the Foot taking out a cop car with an RPG, and it's just, I don't know, I don't think the Foot have really...
It's because he didn't park in the rear. Do you see the sign on the building? It says park in rear, and he's parked out front, so they really enforce that.
You get more Mirage detail. They went pretty crazy with drawing the inside of that car as it explodes.
We should mention that the bus from last issue where the businessman, mm-hmm, was when this broke out, that bus isn't in great shape right now either.
Again, weird there's no panel or two showing that guy, but we get the old man in, yeah, the hospital. So,
like we mentioned last episode, if that were like a modern movie or a Marvel movie, like every couple of pages, it would be like he's typing away on his computer and like someone's head comes through the window and like pulls out, and then like, you know, like, or like a ninja star like appears next to his shoulder while he's like trying to hack.
So the foot soldier on the roof that shot the RPG is taken out by the police helicopter. And I think this is one of the most effective panels in any of the Turtle books. It's him being shot by the helicopter, but it's all in shadow. It's a very effective image the way it's done. And I don't feel like they've done it a lot.
You know what this battle needed, though? Through all the chaos and the fire and the smoke and the flames and everything, we should have just seen, like, the point of view of somebody looking out of their apartment window and like maybe sipping a cup of coffee or something and going like, I'm just sick of this city being at war. I want a title drop.
I don't think we ever get a title drop through this whole series.
It's like, they referenced this on Star Wars Minute, but I know they didn't come up with it. It's from like a famous sketch, and I can't think. It's not The State, but that's what's coming to mind. But some sketch show had a thing about Star Wars like that, where someone was pretending that they were in Star Wars. He's like, no, I had the titular line. I'm sick of all these Star Wars. I can't think of what that's from though.
I don't know. If you know and you're listening, you know, shoot us a tweet. Let us know what that's from.
But might be Upright Citizens Brigade. I think it is. I'm going to go with that. Let me know.
So at this point, Leo kind of takes command and tells his brothers they need to retreat. And we get this really powerful moment that Zach and I had talked about last week that didn't get in the episode because it wasn't in that issue. But there's a...
Was that while my battery was dying because, yes, my plug outlet stopped working?
Yep.
I fixed that, by the way. It turned out the fuse was tripped at some point. I don't know why, but just click the fuse back over and it's working.
So I wanted to bring this up because Zach really brought up a good point. He's from Booyaka Show. He was on last time, so check him out. There's a guy with a Carpe Diem shirt who's impaled by, it looks like a pole. And he's just kind of on the other end of the alley that Leo's trying to get his brothers to come down. And
he has carpe'd his last diem.
Dude, yeah. It's a really effective moment because it's finally showing like the effect this whole situation is having on innocent people. And I feel like it does it better, and this is kind of what Zach and I talked about, than anything they do with that old man. And he's only in this one panel.
Yeah, I don't want to, like, I feel like we can have a thorough analysis on the old man at the end of it, because I kind of want to, like, I'm going to save my view on the old man's story until it's concluded. I'll put it that way.
All right, fair enough.
Stay tuned to learn that.
But it's a really great moment because Leo is taking command. He's trying to get his brothers to safety, and at the same moment is seeing the actual consequences of what they're involved in. And
well, I mean, again, a lot like every Turtle story so far, yes, they're involved and they're trying to help, but again, this isn't like the foot wasn't attacking them. You know what I mean? It's just another thing they happen to be there for, where rival Foot Clan factions are warring at each other, and the Turtles are just kind of like the middleman saying, hey, this is our city and we don't want you doing this. But that, like, I don't, like, it's another thing where it seems like all of Mirage Turtle stories are things that were happening and the Turtles either, like, happened to be there or heard about it and got involved, but it wasn't a direct result of them fighting crime. Like, they are not crime fighters in this comic series. They stop the violence they see, but they're not out trying to prevent future violence.
Yeah, but I feel like in this story, they've made the choice to actively be involved in what's going on because they were...
Well, I know they were out on patrol and, like, looking for stuff, but...
Well, they were investigating.
Yeah, it's just like it's exactly where the book goes is them saying like they're in over their heads, and I think part of the reason they're in over their head is because they didn't even see any of this coming to begin with. Like they were just hoping to find like foot soldiers, you know, like mugging people and stop that. They weren't expecting to see, you know, cop cars getting taken out with rocket launchers while like helicopters circle and like explosions everywhere, and they weren't expecting like a literal war.
So my favorite line from this issue is when they're huddled and I can't tell if they're in an alley or it's just like a loading area.
That's how I interpreted it, was like a loading dock. Yeah, because they go down this like cement staircase and then they're kind of in like a corner.
And they're kind of trying to figure out what's going on, and one of them says, a maelstrom of violence, which I thought was a... I almost feel like that's what you could have titled this issue if
yep.
you were retitling them instead of just doing City at War number whatever. But I think this whole moment is great of the Turtles. They aren't really defeated. They just don't have any forward momentum.
Yeah.
So the fact they have to regroup and Leo is now at the point of, I have no idea what to do. And what, you know, if you go back to Splinter doesn't know what to do. So it's not even like they can go, you know, consult him and be like, Master, this is the situation. What should we do? So I think it's cool to put the Turtles in like this area of disadvantage overall in this story arc. And then
it's interesting that the foot don't seem interested in them at all. It really, I guess what I was trying to say a few minutes ago is it kind of feels like it, like recess. And there's like a group of five kids over here and a group of five kids over here, and they start fighting. And then you try to separate those 10 kids from each other and you fail horribly. And then you're like sad about it. But those 10 kids were never interested in you at all. They were fighting each other. You know, it's like, it's so, it's just an interesting thing that the two warring factions don't seem to have an interest in them yet. You know what I mean?
Yeah, especially with, you know, how we came into Turtles, how the Foot are actively always going after the Turtles.
Yeah.
You know, even in the first movie where once Shredder learns about them, that becomes his mission, and then in Secret of the Ooze, his obsession. Yeah, it kind of is fascinating that whatever this Foot internal war is, the Turtles don't even factor into it for them.
Yeah.
So that,
but
that is,
they are the heroes, so they're going to try to stop it, because like you said, they're seeing innocent people get hurt, they're seeing their city get destroyed. It's like they want to be the ones in charge and say, this is our city, but they can't get the city to listen to them just yet.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I can't really think of like a superhero comic that's done something similar, where the heroes are trying to get involved and the two people, you know, at odds with each other don't even care that the heroes are there.
Yeah, usually some point towards this part of the story would be one of the sides saying, oh, let's become allies of the Turtles and use them and then betray them at the end. Like, you know what I mean? That would be the cliche version of the story. Like, let's get the Turtles to help us shut down that section of the Foot Clan. And then when that's done, we kill them. You know, like, some, that's the bad version, but that would be the cliche version of this story.
So, yeah, Eastman and Laird doing some interesting things, I think, with their heroes. And then, I mean, I feel like the last page was unnecessary, but I get why it's there. We go back to Japan, to that boardroom, and there, Karai is watching all this unfold on the news, and, you know, one of the, I assume one of her lieutenants is just like, you seen enough? She's like, yes, we'll get involved. So that's setting up her intervening, so we don't know yet where she stands on this thing at all. She could be, you know, on her own side. We don't know. But I feel like they could have waited on that panel. I could have been okay with it ending with the guys, you know, they're accepting defeat and trying to figure out how to soldier on.
The way she's looking out the blinds of her window is very close to what I need for, I'm just sick of this city being at war.
Well, maybe they should have had Karai say it right at the end.
Before we move on to our rating, I want to backtrack us towards the beginning, a note that I forgot to say. So you brought up that Robin is the messy sister, and they're really showing that. One thing that I got this time reading through that never really clicked for me before, but this time reading, I was like, it's kind of interesting that Robin seems like she would be a better fit for Casey than April as a couple. And I don't think they're intentionally saying that, but she, you know, she wants to have a good time. She kind of has the same attitude as him. She's a messy person. Like, they wouldn't keep a clean house together, but personality-wise, and maybe that's why April does fit with Casey a little bit. Maybe he reminds her of the family, the type of people in her family. But yeah, it was just a thought I had while reading, and I wanted to make sure I got it out there.
I think that would have been an interesting direction had they not done the stuff with Gabrielle the waitress and had Casey, you know, drive her all the way out there, and then he met the sister, and then they hit it off, and yeah, that would have been an interesting dynamic, I think.
Yeah. So my rating, I gave this book a... Oh, did you have any other notes?
I just got my rating, which...
Oh, okay.
Like I said, things are starting to come together.
Yeah, I like this a little better than last week's book. I gave it a 3.9. Last week I was at a 3.5. It's still lower than a 4, not by much, but it feels like... Like it's going in the better direction. It's got that those great fight scenes. It's just a really good book. It's not quite at the 4 yet, but I gave it 3.9. It's a great book. All of City at War is good in my opinion, but this is one of the better ones.
So I gave it a 4.1 because all four things going on are finally kind of connecting, and now I'm on board.
I think this story, and this is going to sound like a no-duh thing, but this story would have hit better had Mirage been building continuity all the way up to it and not had the guest era. Because it feels like every Mirage story they've ever done, including this one, is it's just trying to get that one story done. And like, look at how IDW from the start, like, is laying seeds for things to grow down the line. And like, they're sprinkling things. Like, you can tell there's a long plan as well as the 4-issue story arc they're focusing on. And you never feel that way with Mirage. It always feels like they're like, okay, this is what happens in this story. You can read just this one if you want and not read anything else.
Yeah, I would agree. I just feel like this issue finally, you know, I already was on board with April, but you get a little more of that. I finally kind of have a reason to root for what Casey's going through and want to see where that goes. The Turtles, I've been on board the whole time, but again, I like the idea. It's just a thing in stories I like, too, when the heroes fail and need to figure out why. And they're finally at least pointing Splinter in a direction. So I feel like all 4 points of the story at least are going somewhere now.
Which, not to get ahead of ourselves, but I could not believe the 2012 cartoon took where this is going and did something with it with Splinter. Like, we'll get there.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, it's crazy that a kid's cartoon used it. But anyway.
Especially since the 2003 took so much from the comics.
I think they used it too. I could be wrong. We always get our second segment here. Let's do some toy figure facts.
Pizza power!
Terminate the Turtles.
Oh, goody. Fresh turtles for lunch. Turtle soup. My favorite. Ha, 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 ha,
ha. You shellheads are dead.
From Playmate.
So because Darth Vader was on the cover of Nintendo Power, and I really couldn't find anything for Trash Can Head, I decided to do one of the most Darth Vader-y toys they made, which was Chrome Dome. You remember Chrome Dome?
Oh, yeah.
The mechanical master of metal?
I think they've got, like, a nicer version of that figure coming out.
Here's some vital tech-tistics. His birthplace was Shredder's Metal Shop. His weight, 600 programmed pounds. That's not how pounds work. I thought this was clever. Favorite flower, steel magnolias.
Oh, that's good.
He's basically a big silver Shredder that kind of looks like Darth Vader. He looks like a big silver. You know what he kind of looks like? What was that second Wolverine movie? The samurai metal thing.
Oh, the Silver Samurai?
Silver Samurai, that's what he looks like. The description. Programmed for peak performance. Programmed for pulverizing pizza-eating peons. He's Chrome Dome. Shredder's synthetic soldier of doom. Transistorized for terror in the Technodrome, this vindictive villain has one command permanently burned into his memory chips. Destroy all turtles. So Bender got that chip and like altered it a little. Shredder packed Chrome Dome with deadly diodes of destruction, making this robotic ruffian the ultimate Shogun warrior. With his own brand of digital dexterity, Chrome Dome wields weapons from his atomic arsenal, and when this metallic menace swings his servo psi and I have no idea what this word is. Gigabyte Gooplion? That must be like a weapon. The turtles must duck or die. Shredder's made this metallic marvel to be just like him, a master of martial mayhem, battle techniques, and everlasting evil. He's one programmer's punk who will never rest unless he rusts. Wow, that was one of the more difficult ones.
Whenever you read those, I always wait for J. Jonah Jameson to come out and go, "No, you're reading it wrong with feeling."
He was part of the 1991 basic figures assortment, so pretty early on there.
He's pretty cheap.
Yeah, he seems like he would be. Like, what is he, like, in package, like, $70?
Close, $90. Although, I don't know what... I found that listing, and I found a listing for a left piece of armor for him. If you want the left piece of armor, I don't know what figure, which chrome dome...
I only want the right piece.
All right, well... That's going to cost you more, but the left piece is going to cost you $200.
What?
That's what it says.
That must be an accessory that everybody lost.
I don't know, but yeah, I think NECA has like a souped up version of this figure coming out. I don't remember Chrome Dome. Like, I don't remember him in the show. He's not in the games, right?
I don't think he was in the show. No, he's just one of the toys. As far as I know, he might be in the Adventures comics. We'll have to keep an eye out. Oh, I forgot. We usually like do the graduating class of what he came out
with. Yeah, I was going to say.
So he came out with Skateboarding Mike, Sergeant Banana. I almost did Skateboarding Mike for this show because we talked about Tony Hawk last week, but not, you know, too much Michelangelo. Skateboarding Mike, Sergeant Bananas, Space Usagi, which is basically an Usagi Yojimbo figure with like a space helmet on, Super Shredder. Hose 'em Down Don, Zach the Neutrino, Dirtbag Ground Chuck, who we talked about on the show, Make My Day Leo, who's the cop Leo, Walkabout, Chrome Dome, we just mentioned, Razar, Worm, Tattoo, and Toka.
Isn't it weird Usagi Yojimbo got two figures and the Foot Soldier and Casey Jones didn't?
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of Splinters either. You'd think they'd make more Splinter figures.
There's only, what, three? Four?
I mean, I'm not going to, I don't know. I haven't looked through all, like, 3,000 of these toys, but we don't see a lot of them, that's for sure. All right, so that's everything we have for City at War Part Quattro. Pretty, you know, it's moving along. I'm digging the story so far. Again, I just wish... My one takeaway from this episode so far, I really do wish that Mirage had been building continuity, you know, all 50 issues leading up to this. I feel like City at War would have felt like more of a payoff, which, you know, when they do City at War in IDW, you can see the difference.
No, I agree. Like I said, I mean, this is the sixth issue of continuity since we've gone back to it, and that's how long it's taken me to finally come around and care about everything going on now.
And just think about if you were picking these up new from the comic book store each time they were released. Like, it's been like 8 years at this point. It's been 8 years that this book's been being published, and the majority of that time it was non-canon issues,
right?
So it must be really hard to get worked up about City at War when the last 6 years has been throwaway stories. It would be like if, well, those aren't throwaway stories, it's a bad example. I was gonna say it would be like if when Peter Parker came back from Superior Spider-Man, if they tried to put him right in like an event book, which they didn't do, but Superior Spider-Man wasn't throwaway stuff. It counted. I can't think of a book where they just took a break on continuity for a while, so it's hard to compare.
It's like if the MCU movies didn't connect.
Yeah.
If all those individual movies were their own self-contained thing, and then you had an Avengers movie where they teamed up.
Yes. But different actors. Like, they're like, okay, starting now is the continuity with these guys.
Well, I mean, I guess they
like if when Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movie was out, there was a successful Iron Man and Captain America movie, and then they made an Avengers movie that had nothing to do with those movies. That's what it would be like. You're right. Yeah.
Which at this point they could do. It'd be okay. I wouldn't have to keep track so much.
So it's like one of those things where you just have to like, and I guess this is, you know, this is art. But it's like you have to focus, and you have to just appreciate it for what it is, which I do, but you can't appreciate it for a piece of a bigger picture, which is something I'm used to doing in comic books because comic books are a long form of storytelling, except Turtles. Turtles are this story is what's important right now form of storytelling. But yeah, it's great. I don't want to like, I feel like we're coming down on it. I don't want to end the episode like this. Like, I love City at War. I shouldn't be complaining like this is one of the bad Turtles. This is great Turtles. I don't know. We're spiraling out of control here, Flanagan. Save us.
So thank you very much for listening. We'll be back with part 5 next time.
Special guest.
Oh yeah, we get special guests coming. So if you haven't figured that out, City at War, we're finally gonna have some folks come on and talk about this with us, since it's our last big arc before we move on. And yeah, I mean, hit us up on Twitter and the email.
Well, we wanted to do guests earlier this season. It's just, you know, if you listen to those episodes, you'll hear our recording schedule kept changing, and it was impossible to book a guest when we didn't know when we would be recording. But anyway,
yeah. Leave a review on Apple, all that good stuff.
Yeah, all the good stuff. If you liked us, leave us a review. If you didn't like us, forget I said that.
The Ninja Turtle Nerds is a fan-supported podcast. If you'd like to support the show, head on over to patreon.com/TMNTNerds. If you'd like to see images of the comics we discussed in this episode, you can follow us on Twitter or Instagram at TMNTNerds. Have a question or comment for us? You can email us at TMNTNerds@gmail.com. And if you like the show, be sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thank you very much for listening.